The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Capital Thinking. With Memorial Day coming up, we wanted to focus this episode a little bit on the heroes of America. That's our military. And we wanted to talk about a very interesting situation that's happening at one of the key sites in the United States for America's heroes, and that's Arlington National Cemetery. Joining us today, our very special guest, is Congressman Rob Wittman from the 1st Congressional District of Virginia, a guy who just happens to coincidentally be my congressman and my favorite congressman. Rob is a key member of the House Armed Services Committee, where he is actually the chairman of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, and that's the group that has oversight, if I can use that word again, of what's going on at Arlington National Cemetery. So, Rob, tell us, I know that there's a challenge going on at Arlington National Cemetery with properly handling the remains of our military heroes. Tell us a little bit about that problem.
Well, Kevin, that's correct. About 18 months ago, there were a number of discrepancies that came to light in the identification of remains and how they related to the location of the headstones. And it was actually precipitated by folks that were going by Arlington National Cemetery and looking on the embankment there and actually seeing headstones being used as breakwaters on the river shore there. And people were wondering, well, why is that? Aren't those headstones supposed to be destroyed? And that led to further investigation to find a whole list of improprieties and mismanagement issues there at Arlington. And the most grievous of those is the misidentification of remains there and sometimes the improper placement of remains. I know just two days before the most recent hearing we had, there was an unmarked grave site there that had eight sets of remains in that unmarked grave site. So what's happening now, our families are questioning the accuracy of the location of their loved ones and that in relation to the location of the headstone. So what we're finding is that particular misidentification of remains, misidentification of locations, and then also, in addition to that, the previous management there was trying to put in place an electronic system to identify grave locations and remains, spent a tremendous amount of money, never got an electronic system in place, so we're still today relegated to a system of paper records. And I know they're in the process of trying to put together an electronic or a digital system to identify remains, location, and all the other pertinent information to go with the remains being interred there at Arlington and trying to get that system up. But what we have from a historical standpoint, the legacy system there is purely a paper system with very little backup. And again, if that paper system is in some way destroyed or damaged, that's the only record system that we have for location of remains and identification of remains there at Arlington.
Well, that's very interesting. Chairman Wittman, can you give us a sense of the scope of how big Arlington National Cemetery is and how many folks are buried there regularly and how big this problem might be?
Yes, well, there are about 300,000 grave sites there at Arlington. To this point, they're supposed to go through and evaluate all those grave sites to make sure that there is clear identification of remains, location of remains, and that they are sure that there is no misidentification. They've done about 22,000 of those grave sites to this point. They're supposed to have it finished by the end of the year, and I think it's pretty clear that probably is not going to happen. they will have as many as 6 to 10 ceremonies a day at Arlington. Of course, that includes people that pass away downrange in current conflicts, but also those veterans that have made arrangements to be interred at Arlington that pass away from previous conflicts. And as you know, the list of those folks that are eligible to be interred at Arlington is very, very specific. So they are making sure that they are standing by their commitment to those folks. And you know, there's been some controversy about a quote-unquote waiting list. We've been assured that there is no waiting list there for Arlington, and I know there's a bill that's been put in to assure that there won't be any waiting list either into the future, and that's just in common courtesy in treating everybody that's eligible to be interred at Arlington fairly.
Yeah, it's really the most hallowed ground on which you can be buried in the United States. And as you said, I mean, it's very difficult to be eligible for the list to get on. And I'm sure everyone can imagine if you're eligible and your family wants you interned there, you want to have that handled with the grace and dignity that heroes deserve. Well, tell us, what's really the biggest challenge as you get into this this situation with us keeping track of where everybody is and making sure that it's all done correctly?
Well, I think the biggest challenge now is to make sure that the Army is fixing the mismanagement there and that those folks that have been at the root of this mismanagement are held accountable. That, from my standpoint, is absolutely critical. As you know, we've questioned the Inspector General at the Army to make sure that they are pursuing the investigation into the wrongdoings or the mismanagement there, and I think it does involve wrongdoings, to make sure that those folks are brought to justice. If there is criminal wrongdoing, we need to make sure that that's taken place. Now, we've been told by the Army that they have taken administrative action against these folks. Some of them have retired. The question is, though, after 18 months since this originally came to light, where are we in that investigation? What are the findings of the Inspector General? And what are they going to do to make sure they're holding people accountable? Those are very significant questions, things that have to be accomplished, I think, in order to reestablish trust in the Army's ability to manage Arlington. Secondly, is to make sure the systems that are put in place there now can clearly identify every set of remains at every gravesite there in Arlington. And we're not at that point yet. Also, to make sure that the record system there has redundancy so that if there is a problem, if there is something that were to get damaged in the original record system, that we would have a backup, and we are not at that point now. So I would say the most pressing issues right now are accountability of past mismanagement and potential wrongdoings. Secondly, is to make sure that the system there now is being properly managed and that the record system has duplicity there in redundancy to make sure that we know exactly, beyond the question, with 100% certainty, the exact location and identification of every set of remains that are there at Arlington and the placement of those remains in relation to the identification on the headstone.
So you're really trying to bring into the current century a system that sounds like it might have been created and used since the cemetery opened right around the Civil War time, right?
That is correct. If you look back in the original logs there that date back to the Civil War, in many of those instances, that's the only record that exists. And Lord forbid if those records were ever damaged or become illegible, there is nothing else to back that up. And we want to make sure that we have that record-keeping system that's accurate and that's redundant.
I'm sure a lot of folks have to be wondering, Chairman Whitman, so if it's happening at Arlington, there's obviously a very large network of military cemeteries around the country and perhaps even around the world. I'm not thinking broadly enough. Did your hearing look into whether or not this is a problem just at Arlington or is this a problem endemic in the veteran cemetery system?
Well, you know, we asked that question. We asked the systemic problems there at Arlington. We also asked if other Veterans Administration cemeteries had some of the same issues. And what we found, at least from the testimony there, was that this particular situation, from the best we can determine, is unique to Arlington. There is a difference, obviously, with Arlington being run by the U.S. Army and the other facilities being run by the Veterans Administration. That naturally begged the question, well, should Arlington be put under the Veterans Administration? And there's been some pushback to say no, that the Army believes that they can handle it. Our big concern is this, is if that is indeed the case, then the Army has to clearly demonstrate that they can do that. 18 months, we believe, is more than sufficient time to correct these past problems, to hold people accountable and to get those things done. So as you can imagine, folks not only on our committee but also the Committee on Veterans Affairs are asking, is this cemetery better placed under the Veterans Administration versus the Army? Now, I think that we're at a situation where we need to hold the Army accountable for what's going on there, and that is probably a premature place to be as far as asking about whether the Veterans Administration should take over Arlington in relation to the other cemeteries that it manages. Arlington is fairly unique in the ceremonies that go on there, and obviously the guard that's there that guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers. So there are some uniqueness qualities to Arlington that does lend itself to say the Army may be better suited. But if the Army can't demonstrate that they can properly manage this cemetery and that they will hold people accountable for past mismanagement, then there are others that will continue to ask that question about who is best capable of managing the cemetery. We want to make sure the Army gets in there, does the job, fixes the mismanagement, and holds those folks in the past that have been there at the time where there was mismanagement taking place, hold them fully accountable.
Great. Well, real fast, Congressman, in the last 30 seconds, anything else Congress is doing to help fix this problem today?
Well, we are. We're continuing to focus our attention on this. I've asked the full committee chairman to hold another hearing. We had one about 12 months ago to close the loop on this and make sure that the Army is doing everything they can and coming back and testifying before us to give us an update on what they're doing, how they intend to fix these situations at Arlington, and make sure that with 100% certainty we know where everybody is buried there without a shadow of a doubt, and that we have held people accountable for the mismanagement and the mistakes of the past.
Very good. Well, we will look to follow up with Congressman Whitman more on this in the future. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk with the founder of Preserve and Honor, which is a website dedicated to Arlington National Cemetery and veterans nationwide. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We are continuing our discussions about Arlington National Cemetery, and we're joined by what I think so far in the history of this show will be the youngest guest we've ever had on. That's Ricky Gilland, who's an 11th grader at North Stafford High here in Northern Virginia. Ricky, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, Ricky, tell us, you are the founder and the primary author of a great new website called Preserve and Honor, which our listeners can find at www.preserveandhonor.com, spelling out the words preserve and honor there. Ricky, tell us a little bit about what that site is.
Well, basically, it's just an online database of everyone buried at Arlington National Cemetery who served in the Global War on Terror. So anyone can go on, and they can go and search for a name, or they can just browse their database. And when they're looking for somebody, it has all their information on there. Everything that's on the headstone, you know, date of birth, their name, rank, branch of service. You can also see a picture of their headstone right there alongside with all that information. Another great thing is you can also, there's a link, and you can click and view more information like a bios and, you know, personal stories and that sort of thing, really learn more about the person instead of just a name or a number of a casualty.
So, Ricky, I have to ask you, I mean, you're an 11th grader in high school. What was your inspiration as a guy who I'm sure is busy with SAT prep and getting ready to figure out where you're going to college and probably some extracurricular activities? How did you get inspired to do this?
Well, I've always been interested in computers and stuff like that. And after reading about all of this mismanagement and everything in Arlington and in the Washington Post and all of the problems surrounding that, I just felt it was a really great idea to make a website and put all this information out there for people to see.
And we just talked to Congressman Whitman, who's telling us, you know, the records at Arlington National Cemetery are literally paper records that go back 100, 150 years in many cases. And here you are, you have a state-of-the-art digital record of everyone who's died in the Global War on Terror and has been buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Walk us through the steps of, you know, and the time involved for you to actually do that.
Well, I mean, it took about 3 months initially to complete, and, I mean, it's really not, it's pretty simple, actually. We went to Arlington, walked all of the rows of Section 60 where most of the Global War on Terror veterans are buried, and we just walked along, took pictures of all the headstones toward the front and the picture at the back as well, then took all the information off of that, put it into an online database, and made it a website.
And it looks to me, I'm looking at some of the pictures here on the blog feature of the website, Ricky, looks to me like maybe you were there around Christmas time. I see a lot of wreaths on some of these headstones. Is that right?
Right, right.
Was that Veterans Day? Or?
That was one of the times that we'd gone up, because we go up every, you know, about 2 to 3 weeks to update the site, get new burials and everything. And so that was around the time when we had gone for one of our updates.
I see. And I see here you've got a blog feature and you've got a lot of comments. What do you think a blog like this and a website like this means for family members and staying connected to their loved ones?
Well, I really hope it provides somewhat of a closure to them. I mean, I've gotten a lot of emails and comments and things like that from family members and friends, and they've all pretty much expressed the same thing, that it's really great to be able to, you know, whenever they're having a bad day or things just aren't going well, to sit down, kind of decompress a little bit, and just reflect on their loved ones.
Yeah, you've gotten some good press coverage out of this, right? You've been written up in some newspapers and whatnot?
Right, right. I've been featured in a local newspaper down here in Fredericksburg. I was also in the L.A. Times, and I was in a TV interview for a D.C. station.
And some of the, I think the L.A. Times story talked a little bit about the impact that you have on families who in Los Angeles are 3,000 miles away from where their family member is buried, but have a chance to visit virtually and maybe post comments or just see the headstone of their family member. Is that, have you had a lot of contact with families as a result of this?
Quite a bit, actually. I mean, I've had people tell me that this is such a great thing because, you know, people who live, like you said, 3,000 miles away, and maybe they just came up here for the burial, but they weren't here when the headstone was placed. Never seen the headstone before. So now they can go on, and really quickly and easily, they can see a nice picture of the headstone. You know, if they want, they can write about the person, read about them. Makes them feel better.
And which of the stories that you've been writing about on your blog or has touched you the most? I mean, I imagine you must see some very interesting personal items, photos, and keepsakes that folks are leaving on the headstones there in Section 60. What has sort of hit home with you?
Well, I think the ones that really hit home is when a lot of times you'll go there and there'll be, you know, flowers and stuff like that. And we went there one time. And there was this big bouquet of flowers and just a sonogram sitting there. And it just makes you think, like, here's this child who will never know their father.
Sure, sure. I'm sure that's and do you see a lot of family members there? Do they come up and ask you, you know, what are you doing, taking pictures of my son or daughter's gravesite?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time we go up there to update and everything, there's always a lot of people there, and you know, every now and then they'll walk up and ask, you know, hey, what are you doing here? And we'll explain to them, and you know, talk a little bit about them, and ask them about, you know, who they're visiting, and we haven't really got any negative thing about it. I mean, everyone thought it was great.
I see. And how many hits are you guys getting on this website? What's your daily traffic look like?
Well, it slowed down a lot since the Times interview, but. On a good day, a few hundred to a thousand a day now, about the average.
I would think that's pretty significant. And give us a sense, Ricky, of how many folks are buried in Section 60. You know, the congressman was just talking about overall how many are buried in the cemetery at Arlington National.
And just Section 60 alone, there's a couple thousand. I mean, it's pretty vast. There's a lot of people there.
A couple thousand and obviously growing. As you said, every couple weeks you're having to go back and update that. There's room to add more. Well, tell us a little bit about how people can help you fulfill the mission of PreserveAndHonor.com.
Well, what we'd really like is for people to go around to their local cemeteries, you know, cemeteries in Ohio and places not around here, obviously, and go and find those Global War on Terror veterans. Take their pictures, get all their information down, personal stories, that sort of thing. Then they can submit it to our website. We actually have a feature coming on the next week or two that they can submit it directly to the website. And that would really help to make the site go national rather than just being in Arlington, having just them.
Right, because obviously only a small percentage of folks are from the Global War on Terror are buried in Arlington. Many of them have chosen, their family members have chosen to bury them closer to home or in other facilities where they can visit more often or for a variety of reasons. So you're looking to become the clearinghouse for everyone who's been affected by the Global War on Terror in the military to have these pictures on the site.
That would be the hope. I mean, I would like to have as many as possible on there, and eventually probably start expanding to other wars as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, it seems to me we've obviously seen in particular the World War II generation reaching that stage where the age suggests that we're getting a very dwindling population, and I know that continues to be a driving force of folks that are buried at Arlington National Cemetery, Korea and Vietnam numbers sort of picking up there as well. How do you pick and choose what to expand to next?
We'll probably just kind of start accepting everyone pretty soon. We won't be limited to anything.
I see. And what do you think, obviously we talked to Congressman Whitman about the situation with how difficult it is for the military to know what they've got going on at Arlington National Cemetery. Do you think that your project will spur the military to sort of take this over or do some of these things on their own?
Well, I mean, that would be the hope. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, upstage anyone or anything like that. You know, I'm just a kid. I just made a website. But, you know, I'd really like to hope that somewhere it's kind of making a little bit of motivation, at least, to get this squared away.
Yeah, well, listen, don't sell yourself short. You're an 11th grader with an incredibly impressive commitment to public service by putting this website together. You're providing a very valuable role for family members. I have to ask you, I mean, are you at least getting some school credit somewhere? Do we have an A in a class, at least history or something, because of this project?
No, nothing like that.
Nothing like that. Well, I have to also think it's going to help you with your college applications. I mean, is this the sort of thing that you talk about that, you know, when you're looking to go to school?
Definitely, because, I mean, I'd like to go to Annapolis, which is a military academy, so I would think that this would weigh fairly heavily on that.
Gotcha. Well, tell me, I know that you've had some interaction with Chairman Whitman in particular about this issue, and I don't know if he's your congressman or another district, but tell us a little bit about your interaction with members of Congress and preserveandhonor.com.
Well, I mean, the only interaction I've had was, like you said, Congressman Whitman, and, you know, that was really nice. We sat down, we talked about Arlington a little bit and, you know, what they're doing in Congress to try and speed up the process of getting the records taken care of at Arlington.
Yeah, not too many 11th graders get to meet face-to-face with their member and talk about a substantive issue that makes a difference for a lot of people. So I don't know if you were maybe living here in the D.C. area, you weren't scared or intimidated by that, but certainly you should be impressed that you have the opportunity to get in there and make a difference on an issue you care about.
It was an awesome experience.
Ricky, what can, besides taking pictures and adding to your database, is there anything people can do to support the website, provide financial assistance, anything like that you're looking for?
No financial assistance. I mean, the only thing we're looking for right now is volunteers, or maybe if they want to, you know, if they know someone that's on the site, they can submit a little story for the blog or something like that. But, I mean, it's self-sufficient as it is. We don't need any financial support at all. If anyone really wants to donate, there's, you know, great organizations like Wounded Warriors. You know, they'd be happy to have the donations.
Well, that's great. I mean, you've got something that's free for people to use, doesn't require financial support, and I think, one of the things we didn't touch on is obviously you come from a military background. As you can, people can see on the website, you trace your military history to a relative who fought at Gettysburg, and so that's fantastic. Ricky, tell us again the website here before we sign off.
It's www.preserveandhonor.com.
All right. Folks, we've been joined by Ricky Gilland, an 11th grader at North Stafford High School, who's created one of the best websites we've seen in the military community, Preserve and Honor, a chance for you to go in and pay homage to the folks who fought and made the ultimate sacrifice in the global war on terror. Ricky, many congratulations to you on what you've done. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patent Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody. Well, we're going to switch gears from talking about Memorial Day and the issues surrounding Arlington National Cemetery to talking a little bit about Internet privacy and the vulnerability of teenagers on the Internet. And we're joined by our Internet privacy guru. That's Deborah Lodge, a partner of mine at the law firm of Patton Boggs here in Washington, D.C. Deborah, welcome back to the show. Start off by telling us a little bit about why online privacy is sort of popping up as a hot topic again for children and teens.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm delighted to be here, and this is quite remarkable, actually, following a teenager on your show. And clearly a lot of the impact these days relates to online privacy issues respecting children and teens. It's always been a hot issue. The FTC has a specific act that it enforces called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And recently, on May 12th, the FTC announced a $3 million consent agreement with the Disney company Playdom for violating those COPPA provisions. That's no small change, and these are, hot issues. As I'm sure you noted, there was a breach that Sony announced about its PlayStation network, and that hacking incident in April put additional focus on kids' privacy because millions of user IDs and personal information was hacked and could be circulating the Internet regarding, identity theft problems. Finally, Capitol Hill has also gotten into this act, and there are several pending do not track or increasing, children's privacy legislation bills pending. Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Joe Barton of Texas, for instance, just introduced a bill to increase the protection for children online. It's called the Do Not Track Kids Act of 2011, in particular, it would extend some of the basic provisions to the teenagers. Right now, they stop at age 13.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit. So I'm always interested, Deborah. I've got an 8-year-old at home who's playing Lego.com mini games and is on some other website that my sister and mother, who are teachers, have sort of sent him to play math-based games and reading comprehension games. Tell me about the current privacy protections for kids like him and teenagers who I know are much further off into the Internet distance than the sites I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, those are key issues, and possibly, you've gotten notices from some of these websites asking for your verified consent if certain kinds of information has been, or if the website wants to glean certain kinds of information. You know, this is basic under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which we call COPPA or COPPA, depending on your accent. And in addition, there's Section 5 of the FTC Act, which has the basic prohibition against unfair and deceptive acts and practices. The FTC has used both these statutes as means for protecting children's privacy. The COPPA requirements are pretty well known and pretty basic, but sometimes, you know, they can be misunderstood or sticky in their application. And the law has been around for a while. It became effective, in 2002. I believe that it was passed in 1998, and then there were a couple of years for rulemaking. It applies to online collection of personal information from children under 13. The rules state what a website operator has to include in a privacy policy, and they require that verifiable consent be obtained from a parent or guardian in certain instances. Now, it's interesting that you referred to, you know, some online games, because there are some applications that kids can have access to that do not, you know, trigger the parental notification. It depends exactly on, you know, what kind of information the website is seeking to get from the child. And it also, you know, restricts the kind of information that the websites can use, you know, for their marketing purposes or disclosing things like that.
Gotcha. Well, tell me, it seems to me like this is one of those areas where regulation can never keep up with innovation. So have things like the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act been effective?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You know, so often technology outstrips the law. I think it has been effective. As I said, it's pretty clear about what it applies to and what it requires. However, concerns over children's identity theft continue to increase. You know, the recent Sony PlayStation hacking incident really enhanced those concerns, and Sony, you know, had to acknowledge that the personal information of millions of its network users had been compromised, and the system was off for a while. You know, downtime is, you know, really not very kind to the users. So a lot of information was taken then, but, you know, Sony, of course, is doing the best that it can to rectify that. And, you know, interestingly enough, actually, you know, COPPA probably did not apply to a lot of that information, because the Sony user accounts were such that, you know, parental consent, or, you know, it had to be a dependent account because credit cards are needed for the gaming, et cetera. But anyway, coming back to COPPA, its application's a bit limited. It applies to commercial websites or internet services that are directed to children under 13 and which collect personal information from the kids, or general websites where the operator knows that personal information is being collected from children under 13. So obviously, you know, one key is, well, what is personal information, since that's what triggers the compliance. Under the rules, it means, you know, individually identifiable information about a child. That's full name, home address, email address, telephone number, or some other information that would allow the kid's identity to be ascertained. The key, though, is that it applies only to kids who are 13, to kids who are under 13, and, you know, so much of the Internet usage and potential identity theft situations relate to kids who are teenagers and, you know, are playing games or online or whatever. I know my 16-year-old is online all the time on Facebook and other things, and, you know,
you
there's
know
a lot of personal information.
You wouldn't know how to use technology to stop her if you tried, I bet.
I try, though.
Well, tell me a little bit about some of the recent actions that have been taken to protect kids in the online area.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, the FTC recently had a case that was called against Playdom, which is a Disney sub, and that agreed to pay $3 million to settle the FTC's charges that COPPA violations had occurred and that, you know, there had been deceptive statements made in the privacy policy. That case related to online virtual world websites, including one that was called Pony Stars, which was a website specifically directed to kids. And the FTC claimed that between 2006 and 2010, over, 800,000 users had registered in the Pony Stars children's site. And the FTC claimed that, private information, personal information about the kids had been collected without having given without all the COPPA regs having been complied with or the parents being asked for parental consent. So there's another cases, too. The FTC also has asked in 2010, it asked for comments on extending COPPA or revising COPPA in various ways, particularly to take into account, cell phones, geolocation issues, and the other kinds of advances in technology that we're seeing. On July 12th, the FTC is co-hosting a forum on child identity theft with the Department of Justice Office of Victims of Crime. And one of the topics is going to be how to improve the security of children's data in an online context.
Very interesting. Now, is that something that you can actually watch online, or is that something you have to be in person for?
I do not know that. I bet if people check on the FTC's website, they've got a terrific website with links to, online children's issues and other things, that we will have that information. And I can always come back, Kevin, and tell you then exactly what's going on and where to find it.
I think we'll definitely have to have you back after the forum on child identity theft so you can share with us what the FTC has done. I mean, Deborah, at the end of the day, obviously the FTC and the federal government can do a lot, but isn't it our job as parents to protect our kids out there and to know a little bit more about where they are and what they're up to?
It sounds so easy when you say it.
Well, that's because I only have an 8-year-old. I don't have a teenager, so it's a little bit easier to get them to go to bed and to turn off the machine. They haven't figured out how to use passwords to lock me out of my own system yet.
That's coming.
That's probably at 9 years old.
Yeah.
Well, we've been joined by Deborah Lodge talking about Internet children's and teen privacy issues and safety. Always delighted to have her. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about how the Republican presidential primary is shaping up for 2012.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, @pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Great show so far, talking to Congressman Rob Whitman and talking about Arlington National Cemetery, and then Ricky Gilliland talking a little bit about his website, Preserve and Honor, what it's doing to recognize the folks who made the ultimate sacrifice in the global war on terror. Got to respect a 17-year-old who's spending that time and putting in that effort for free to help out so many families have a sense of closure and a place to go to grieve and honor their family members. So big salute to Ricky. And then Deborah chatting with us about Internet safety, which is definitely something Mrs. O'Neill talks to me about on occasion at home, wondering, we're in another room, and the son's downstairs playing on the computer, and she's wondering, you know, what he's trolling for out there. Hopefully so far it's just Lego figurines, but something we definitely keep our eye on. As I'm sitting here talking with you in the background, President Obama is speaking at the State Department just a few blocks away from our studios here in Washington, talking a little bit about his new vision for the Middle East. And I wonder if it looks any different from the old muddled vision that the president has been implementing over the last 2.5 years, but more specifically in the last couple months, as the media dubs this the Arab Spring, the rise of nascent democracies across the Middle East and North Africa. The United States has sent an incredibly muddled message to many of those communities, choosing to intervene or not to intervene in various countries for reasons that don't seem very obvious to folks that are learned observers here in the United States, let alone Arabs on the street in the countries that are impacted. We've in many cases waited too long to get involved. Egypt, an example. Now Syria, another example. The president's been calling in this speech for Syrians to stop shooting protesters. That's terrific, but we need to be doing more. And in Libya, where we seem to be involved in a number of half measures, we're asking Mr. Gaddafi to leave very politely, and we're hoping to conduct some air raids that minimize his ability to conduct offensive operations against his own protesting citizens. But we're not really going in as much as we can to clear out somebody we know is a dictator who's taking action against his own people. So while I read the bottom scroll here, the president's speech, I don't see a whole lot new about what he's saying. He's saying now the status quo isn't sustainable. And again, I don't know if he's referring to the Middle East or his policies towards the Middle East, but it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Well, we did want to talk about the people who are challenging the president for the right to be the Republican nominee in 2012 and run against Barack Obama in the November 2012 election. It's been a very interesting and newsworthy week on that front. Probably the biggest news is really the implosion in the very first opening days of the Newt Gingrich for President campaign, the implosion of that campaign when Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House and a guy who spent the better part of the last decade being a very provocative thought agent in the conservative movement, he entered the presidential campaign officially last week and was on Meet the Press on Sunday and basically took a blowtorch to Paul Ryan, the House Republican Budget Committee chairman's proposal to reform Medicare.
And Gingrich basically said that it was something he didn't think conservatives could accept. And then he said it in very plain language, which is unfortunate for former Speaker Gingrich. And he's now had to spend several days sort of walking back his remarks in a number of contexts. He's gone so far as to call Chairman Ryan and apologize. He's appeared in a number of media outlets. He's been using social media to apologize. But basically, Gingrich got jumped on by the very conservative movement that spawned him, saying, no, you misunderstand. We're strongly behind the Paul Ryan proposal here to reform Medicare and fix entitlements. And we don't like, Mr. Gingrich, what you're proposing. Gingrich came very close, it seems, to embracing the individual mandate that it's the heart of that is at the heart of Obamacare and the health care bill that passed last year, and which is basically what the conservative movement is fighting against, both in the courts and in the halls of the House of Representatives, which is led by Republicans right now. I think a lot of conventional wisdom is that Newt Gingrich's campaign peaked last week when he announced, and that Sunday started a decline that he can't possibly stall out at this point. It's only a matter of when he might get out as opposed to if he might get out. So that's going to be very interesting to see, especially as it's the end of May here. Newt's about 30 days away from announcing his fundraising totals. I don't suspect that, given the remarks he made this week, that he'll see very robust fundraising for his first quarter in action, and that's usually the death blow. Transitioning to fundraising, though, there's a guy named Mitt Romney, who's the clear Republican frontrunner at this stage for the nomination, and he's had a whiz-bang fundraising quarter and a tremendous day. Monday, Mitt Romney brought together about 800 of his leading individual fundraisers, including some of my friends and colleagues here in the political world, in Las Vegas, and had a call day where they all reached out and touched their friends and their networks, asking them to contribute to Mitt Romney for president. And at the end of the day, Romney had been expected to set expectations to raise about $1.5 to $2 million. They announced they raised more than $10 million in contributions. And that's interesting because obviously he can keep up that sort of fundraising pace. It gives him a tremendous advantage, a real advantage, but also a very noticeable psychological advantage on the rest of the field that he is the front runner. He's the one to come after. And it raises some questions about whether or not he might actually have the capability to raise enough money to challenge the president, who is capable of raising several $100 million to fund his reelection and won't have to worry about spending that money on a primary run-up like Romney will have to. So Romney off to just a terrific start, and people will be watching very carefully his fundraising numbers when they come out in early July for this first quarter, because by all indications, he is set up to have tremendous fundraising. Now, sticking with the fundraising theme, we've got Michelle Bachmann, representative from Minnesota, who's expected to announce she's running for president in the next few weeks. One of the things that's motivating her is she has an army of small donors who are giving to her online and recommending that she run. One of the folks I really rely on here for very good data is telling me he expects Michelle to launch, and that she really sees, with Sarah Palin stepping out, with Donald Trump not launching his vanity campaign, with Newt Gingrich self-destructing, that Bachmann sees a real role for her on the two primaries inside the Republican primary. There'll be the mainstream candidate primary, and there'll be the primary aimed directly at the heart of the conservative activist. And Bachmann thinks she has a real opening in that conservative activist primary to be the leader, especially in the early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. It's going to be fascinating to see how the media basically views a Republican woman who's running for the nomination from the get-go here in 2012. Tim Pawlenty, not much news on his front. He seems to be taking the slow and steady approach to ramping up and becoming a presidential contender. He seems to think, I think based on his moves, that he's going to be able to wait out a lot of the other contenders and basically emerge as the consensus anti-Romney choice for a lot of folks. So he's not, again, racking up a lot of spectacular victories, but he's very quietly putting together an organization and a fundraising apparatus that will allow him to be viable. May not raise as much money as Bachmann, may not raise as much money as Romney. I would bet against that, actually, but should be in a position to be seen as a credible challenger as we get close. Mitch Daniels, we're expecting him to make a decision virtually any day. He's being pushed and prodded by what's left of the Bush establishment in Washington and by a lot of his fellow governors around the country to get in. And if he gets in, he could become the leading Romney alternative almost by default. It's going to be a fascinating summer for the Republican primary, something we're going to cover more and more here as Capital Thinking gets into the dog days of summer. We hope everyone enjoys a great weekend. Capital Thinking is going to be back with another great show next Thursday. Until then, keep it here on this network.
For Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.